Well, hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to our Tenpenny Files premium members who are listening to these special deep dive interviews done specifically for you. During our deep dive interviews, we have a personal conversation with our guests about what inspires them and to find a little bit more about who they really are. We know so many of these people by their book or by what they talk about on stage or by their interviews, but this is a little bit more personal conversation to get to know them a little bit better. So with that, let me introduce to you our featured deep dive guest today, Dr. Naomi Wolf. One of the world's most influential feminists, Naomi Wolf doesn't just comment on the world's most pervasive problems, she aims to solve them. A charismatic personality with a passion for activism, Dr. Wolf has long challenged conventional narratives on gender, foreign policy, economics, and journalism. In her speeches and seminars, she expresses the threats to liberty and democracy, providing audiences with the tools to fight back against the powerful institutional forces. She is a best-selling author, columnist, and professor. She is a graduate of Yale University and received her doctorate at Oxford. She's the co-founder and CEO of DailyClout.io, a successful civic tech company. Her most recent book, The Bodies of Others, The New Authoritarians, COVID-19, and the War Against Humanity, we went into deep conversation about that in our first interview on This Week with Dr. T. And if you missed that interview, that discussion, that conversation, you really do need to go back and listen to all of those details. I had said at that time, and I'll say it again, I could talk to her for another 4 hours. We have so many different things that we could talk about. So I am so grateful, Dr. Naomi, for joining us here for the deep dive for our premium podcast members and the generosity of your time to spend with us here today.
I'm so happy to be talking to you, Dr. Tenpenny. As I shared in our earlier conversation, I'm a huge fan. So this is a thrill for me.
Well, thank you. Well, I always like to ask people to start this discussion because it's a pull back the curtain and who are you? You know, where were you born? And tell us a little bit about your childhood growing up that led you into the position of being one of the most influential feminists in the world today.
Thank you. Well, I was born in San Francisco and my parents were pretty bohemian. My dad was a poet and an English professor, a Chaucerian actually. And my mom was, when I was growing up, was a graduate student in anthropology. She's now a past life regression therapist.
Oh my goodness.
A very good one, a very successful one. So they're both amazing, but they're both very open-minded, to say the least, intellectually. And there was no question that couldn't be asked. And they listened to us very seriously. And I guess I have to really credit my dad because he apprenticed me as a writer from a very young age. So I was really trained in the craft of writing. And, you know, you can kind of, I hope, readers of my prose can see that I know how to take care with language in a way that a lot of people don't, you know, are not privileged to be able to do because I had this training from my dad from a very early age. I would say that the time and place in which I grew up really affected me too, in addition to, you know, such an open-minded family, because it was a very physically beautiful environment. I thought the whole world looked like San Francisco in the 60s and 70s, you know, like beautiful, scenic, you know, gorgeous vistas. I thought that was everything. I was astonished to come east and find out that there were
ghettos and the projects and all of those things.
You know, industrial wastelands.
Yeah.
And also, it was, especially in my teenage years, San Francisco was a community that was, and my high school was a high school that was very meritocratic, meaning that it was a city in which working class Chinese immigrants were organizing to become very influential politically. The gay and lesbian liberation movement was organizing to become very influential. It was a, you know, in my own high school, it was very not balanced racially because the Chinese kids were so much smarter than the white kids. You know, I found out I was let in as an affirmative action admission because white kids' standards were lowered so that there could be some white kids in my high school.
Oh,
so,
wow.
I know. So I grew up in a California in which, you know, you weren't necessarily at the top of the pyramid just because you were white, right? And so I really was shown that America could be super meritocratic, and with hard work, you know, anyone could lead and anyone could, you know, get that, you know, free education at Berkeley or whatever. And so I was surprised to go east as a young adult and go to Yale and find out that, you know, I was, you know, supposed to be at the top of the pyramid because of my race. I was surprised to see that there was structural racism, you know, and I was surprised to see the class system was as intact as it was on the East Coast, because again, I'd really grown up, and this affects my politics. I think I'm very hopeful about this country. I'm very hopeful that if we restore, you know, people's basic rights in our Constitution, anyone can succeed, you know, and that race and class don't have to be these rigid barriers between us, because I grew up in a very inclusive meritocratic environment.
Did you have siblings?
Yes, I had more siblings than I knew. I have a brother, Aaron, with whom I grew up, who's my mom's and dad's son, so my full brother, and he's an earth scientist now, and he teaches at OSU. And I also had a half-brother of whom I was not aware, who's a doctor, and we found that out when I was, gosh, about 20 years ago. He had been estranged from my father. My father was not in touch with his mother, but, you know, he's my half-brother. And so he connected with our family, and now we're really happy to know that we have another sibling. And, you know, my dad was a, you know, God bless him, a very charismatic, handsome guy, and loved women. And there may be others out there of whom I am unaware. So if you're listening to this and you're my sibling, you know, please reach out.
Yeah. That's interesting. If you, in your career path, you know, is pretty academic, you know, with the things that you've done along your career path, if you could go backward in time and do anything different, would you?
I mean, that's a great question, Dr. Tenpenny. I do feel that my career was derailed from its intended course by my having been, you know, sexually abused or molested by a famous professor at Yale, Dr. Harold Bloom, because unfortunately at that time, Yale really, well, you know, until the day he died, Yale really covered up this well-known predator's record of abusing his female students. So he was also the most distinguished professor and intellectual in my chosen field, which was Victorian studies. So basically, when this happened, I realized I had to completely change course. I couldn't be an academic in Victorian studies because his shadow would loom over everything I would ever try to do. I'd never get a job. So I had to pivot and become a nonfiction writer. And, you know, luckily I was a successful nonfiction writer. I had 8 bestsellers, but it's not what I'd wanted to do. I always wanted to be a professor in Victorian studies.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. When you're not working, because you have a lot of balls in the air, you do a lot of things. What do you like to do for fun?
Well, luckily I have a super fun husband, and he's very, he spent decades in the weapons community, and he's highly trained in things like shooting and throwing knives and, you know, survival. And so he's teaching me to shoot, and I really do enjoy that. We're going shooting this Friday, out here. And I do like to cook, even though I'm a bad cook.
Is there such a thing, really? I don't know.
My kids can tell you, absolutely. I'm giving up. And I do love my electric bike. And I think, you know, since I had this near-death experience about a month ago in which I almost died in the hospital, I do feel like I've gotten a second chance, and I want to make the most of just being physically well again and you know, biking, swimming, all the things that I can still do.
You know, you're obviously very well read. I mean, from your literature background and your academics and all those different things, do you have a particular, a favorite author that you like?
That is such a great question. Who is the gift that keeps on giving? I mean, I would say Orwell has probably had the most influence on me as a stylist, but you know, I love the Victorians, and I mean, Austen's not Victorian, she's pre-Victorian, but there's not an Austen book that I don't think is perfect. And, you know, I love like the Brontes. I'm always going to go back to the 19th century.
What got your interest in the 19th century literature? That's, you know, it's kind of a narrow niche. What got your interest in that? Was that your father's being a Chaucerian, or was it something else?
He's a medievalist. Understood my interest in the 19th century. It's less narrow than you would think. I mean, I think one of the things then that really excites me about the Victorian period, and my book Outrages, which was canceled and pulped in 2019, allegedly because of two mistakes, which weren't mistakes, but it's very interesting because it's got a chapter on 19th century epidemics and how the state, the British state, used cholera and typhus epidemics as a pretext to control the population's civil liberties and medical freedom, right? So that got trashed in 2019, canceled, withdrawn, you know, again, a global kind of attack on my reputation. But anyway, the 19th century excites me. And I think that book is an example because everything we think of as modern originated in the 19th century. So feminism, we think it kind of, you know, was full blown in the 60s and 70s. Not true. It was really invented in the 19th century. That was the first wave of the feminist movement. The abolition movement, you know, the discussion about racial justice originated in the United States in the 1840s. Hippies, transcendentalism, again, 1840s, you know, the Bronson Alcott and Walden and Thoreau and Emerson, they were all introducing this idea of the transcendental relationship of humans to the natural world and seeing God in the natural world and creating a visionary society in which everyone was equal. That's not new in the 1960s. That, you know, that really originated in the 1840s, 1850s. You know, the innovation, like universal education, the reform movement, you know, getting kids out of child labor, not letting elderly people die in the street, you know, because they have no pensions, or putting them in workhouses, you know, Social Security, all of these things originated with the visionaries of the 19th century. And so I feel like our modern world really originated in the 19th century. And if you want to understand what's happening now, you have to go back and really dive into the 19th century. The gay and liberation, you know, gay and lesbian liberation movement, we think that that started with Stonewall. It totally didn't. My book, Outrages, is about a pioneering LGBTQ, it wasn't called that at the time, but, you know, homosexual rights pioneering. Mm-hmm. Named John Addington Symonds, who was born in 1840. He died at 52, but he wrote the first gay rights manifesto, arguing that people shouldn't be discriminated against because of whom they happen to love and be attracted to. So it was all like laid out in the 19th century. And one thing that drives me crazy is the way we're encouraged to be historically ignorant, as well as illiterate now. And that is so disempowering to us, because if we don't know what happened or how we got here, they can, you know, there's never been an infectious disease before. Well, I knew that the lockdown was an overreaction because I've read English literature spanning the last 400 years. There've been waves of infectious diseases in, you know, typhoid, yellow fever, cholera, you know, the Spanish flu, I mean, smallpox, infectious diseases are not new. So I knew from reading 19th century and early 20th century literature and journals and journalism that the lockdowns were completely pointless because they've never happened before and because infectious diseases are going to find a way to transmit, whether you lock people down or not. And also in the progressive era when they were really dealing with infectious diseases without, you know, remedies, they did the opposite of what we were being told to do. They opened the windows. They built playgrounds for kids. They gave kids cod liver oil and vitamin D and sunshine, and they didn't crowd generations together in close quarters. They knew that that was how you transmit infectious diseases. So from that reading, I knew that what we were being told was not true.
You know, I worked, this was probably 2016 or 17. It might have been 18. I don't know. Everything all blurs together after a while. I was working on a book called They're Coming After You Next. And it was before, right when they declared the adult mandates that were the adult mandatories. That was released in 2015. So it must have been around that time. And part of the book was this historical backdrop of, you know, the great migration that happened, like, what, 1850 to about 1880, when thousands of people were arriving into New York Harbor every single week and living in just the most abject, horrible places down underneath the ground. You know, they would go down and there'd be like people small, like a 12 by 12 room. It would have like a whole family in it, and they would eat, sleep, you know, defecate, all this other stuff in there. And they had all the wasted vegetables, the things that nobody else would eat, when they were right willing to be thrown in the garbage. And all they were talking about all the diseases, these disease people, because they were escaping diseases in Europe to come over to America. And like you said, it was cholera, typhus, typhoid, you know, smallpox and measles barely even made the list. But we made such a big deal and still do, because we've got a vaccine for those particular pathogens. And so we continue to make really big deals about them. So I totally agree with you. If we, you know, I've always said, if we don't know where we came from, how do we know where we're going? And this destruction of history now, not teaching history in kids and in high school or college or any of those things anymore, not tearing down statues of people from our historical backdrop. It's just horrifying to me when I see these things that are happening around me.
Well, you're quite right, Dr. Tenpenny, and it's not a marginal issue at all. It's very central, and it's right out of the playbook of the Chinese Communist Party, you know, the Cultural Revolution. They prepared the way for complete tyranny and destruction of their society by erasing their own history and tearing down the statues and, you know, excising the history books. And that's happening very systematically in the West. And that's the subject of an upcoming Substack. It's making me crazy. I live in the Hudson Valley. It's an incredibly historically rich area. All of these important, you know, President Van Buren's house, the place on the Hudson River where Robert Livingston, one of the signatories of the Declaration of Independence, lived, you know, Gloucester, Mass, which is another place that we visit, you know, where, you know, an important fishing industry was part of American history, you know, even Salem, Mass, you know, the site of the witch trials. All of these places are closed still, like 2.5 years later. These historical sites are closed. And the museums that are still open, I've noticed that they've been redone so that the timeline is scrambled. You can't tell, like, there are exhibits that are like in alphabetical order instead of chronological order.
Oh, wow.
Literally scrambled. Wow. And you can't tell what is the context. I see this prow of a boat. What's the context? There's no context. I see this piece of china. What's the context? There's no context. So at the end of it, kids and adults have no idea what happened. You know, I most recently went to this historic site across the Hudson River where one of the great Hudson River painters was, you know, had his studio. And literally by the end of our tour, we had no idea who this guy was, where he was born, when he died, what his influences were, what impact he had. But the curators had solicited the Guerrilla Girls, who are this, you know, feminist art critiquers, right, to basically dismiss and mock the Hudson River Valley School of Artists. And they just said they're patriarchal. They're, you know, they left out women. They, you know, were imagining an Eden that didn't exist in the United States. It was already industrial. Well, these chicks didn't even do any basic research into the 1840s, this period that I mentioned to you before, when this Hudson River Valley painter was active, because these people were abolitionists, they were feminists, they were fighting for the rights of enslaved people, they were fighting for the legal rights of women. I mean, these chicks just dismissed, and that was like the intention. It's like, there's a force that's trying to teach our kids that American history is just a history of crimes and, you know, shamefulness. Yeah. And it is not true. And they're doing it at the expense of the actual historical record. So this is happening everywhere. You know, the destruction of our history and the false smearing of our history. Juneteenth, you know, if you look at Juneteenth images on Google, they're all manufactured by the same graphic designer, which is weird. But that's very common for like Black Lives Matter or, you know, the, you know, pussy hat protests, or, you know, there's this kind of central manufacturing now of left-wing protest and left-wing kind of ideology. Juneteenth isn't left-wing. It shouldn't be. Juneteenth, like the abolition movement, came about because of white and Black Americans fighting to end slavery. You know, like so many white and Black Americans together fought to end slavery. And the fact that it's a victory of people of various races ending slavery is just being completely written out of the record of Juneteenth. And it's being represented as an all-Black holiday. It's not an all-Black holiday. It's an American holiday celebrating an incredible victory by Americans to end a horrible injustice. And that's what's happening.
Wow. Well, again, we're running short on time for all the different things I'd like to ask you, but I want to ask you this because I think it's germane to our conversation and to our first conversation. We spent time talking about the Geneva Bible and, you know, the Hebrew thing and how that sort of changed. I'm going to ask you two questions in sequence. I think you can probably do them together. How is this, since you've been doing the work with the Hebrew translations and the Geneva Bible, how has that impacted your personal spirituality? And how would you like to be remembered as you pass on?
These are great questions. Well, you know, as we shared in our last conversation, the big takeaway for me from reading the Geneva Bible and comparing it to the Hebrew is that God is much nicer than, you know, the last 500 years of translations have portrayed him to be, and much more intimately concerned with us in a super loving way. So I guess I have to say that's been quite reassuring to me because, you know, the God of organized religion is so distant and mean that when we're in a time in which there's massive death and disability being inflicted on human beings, you know, you kind of feel like God's done with you, you know, or with humans and doesn't care about us. But now I feel like whatever we're going through is an invitation, you know, from a very loving God to kind of get it right and save ourselves with him, you know. So I'm less depressed.
That's good.
Yeah, it is. It is good. And I'll also share one other thing. You know, we talked about my health issues. I broke my shoulder. I had appendicitis. I had an infection. I almost died. In each case, I had quite a miraculous recovery. And in the case of my shoulder, people prayed over my shoulder, and it literally, the before and after picture of my x-rays, I put them online because after the prayer, like literally my bone knit, you know, an inch, like visible, like healing. So, and, you know, a month ago, I was literally near death and I feel fine now. So I guess I sort of feel like human beings in alignment with God's will or love or whatever, that we have incredible untapped healing opportunities available to us. And I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. I don't get that, but I definitely feel like I'm experiencing it. You know, like I can't explain how these things have happened, but I know so many people are praying for me that something's happening that I don't understand. So that's an answer to your question about, you know, how has it affected me?
And how would they, you know, 100 years from now or 50 years from now, When people are starting to look back at this point in time and they're starting to write about us and all the things that we've done during this period of time, how would you like them to remember you and reflect on what you've done?
Thank you. Well, first, I hope I am remembered because women tend to be written out of history. And people who follow me on social media may notice that I periodically say, my team broke that story. You know, my team broke that story. I broke that story. I think it's important for women to be credited for their work because their legacy is often misappropriated or erased or assigned to others who often tend to be male. So I hope I'm remembered. And I guess I just want to be in that lineage of people who didn't give up on the Constitution.
That's very good. That's another whole hour conversation I know that we could have. So Dr. Naomi Wolf, where can people find you, follow you, support your work?
Thank you. Please follow me and my team on dailyclout.io and please become members or donate because, you know, your support does keep us going. And thank you for supporting Dr. Tenpenny's work because, you know, what an important voice. And also you can order the Pfizer Documents book, which it's a life-saving book, which has these almost 50 reports about what's really in the Pfizer documents, help you identify symptoms of yours or loved ones, hopefully make treatment better and more targeted. And you can order it right there on dailycloud.io. And you can follow my Substack on Outspoken on Substack under my name, Naomi Wolf.
Yes, and I encourage all of our listeners to please go and support the work that this woman is doing and read her books because they're very enlightening, very inspiring, and easy to read. You know, sometimes technical books, you know, that are nonfiction types of books, they tend to get bogged down. You have a lovely writing style that it just sounds conversational. So it's a page turner because you just want to see what the next thing is that you want to say. So it's just really delightful. So I want to thank you again so much for the generosity of your time, the ability to finally get to quote unquote meet you, you know, on Zoom, like we so meet so many people these days, and to be able to have this great conversation. I learned so much and I'm just truly honored that you spent this time with us. So as we close out today, I want to say once again, thank you so much to our premium members. Your monthly support makes our work possible. Thank you for your kindness, for your prayers, for your love over the last few years, and for the things we are doing going ahead. So with that, I close out all of my podcasts, whether they're live or pre-recorded, with one of my favorite verses from the Bible, which is Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So until we meet again on the next broadcast, stay strong, stay in prayer, trust in God. He will never let you down. Naomi, thank you again so much for being here with us. And one last thing before we go, stick around for a couple of extra minutes. You'll hear some special offers just for our premium members right after this broadcast. So have a great week, everyone. Thank you again, Naomi. Take care.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.